Welcome to Conversations with Alan Wolper, a half-hour audio biography featuring unique personalities whose lives and ideas are on the cutting edge. Alan Wolper is an award-winning journalist and a professor at Rutgers University Newark. And now, here's Conversations with Alan Wolper.
When alums of Princeton gather anywhere, there's a place they think of longing to be there. It's the one and only university, situated and celebrated in New Jersey. Going back to Nassau Hall. Going back to the best damn place of all. Going back from all this earthly ball. We'll clear the track as we go back. Going back to Nassau Hall. And then we'll crash through that line of blue and send the backs on round the end. Fight, fight for every yard. Princeton's honor to defend. Rah, 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 rah. Tigers, sis, puma, and locomotives by the score. For we'll fight with a limb that is dead, sure to win for all Nassau.
Princeton University, which U.S. News and World Report rates as the best university in America, ahead of Harvard and Yale, where some of the best and brightest of America have taught and attended. Presidents like Woodrow Wilson and James Madison, writers like F. Scott Fitzgerald, Toni Morrison, and Joyce Carol Oates. Now the school's alumni magazine has anointed a new legend of Princeton, Jeff Nunakawa, an English professor who specializes in Victorian literature, who will soon publish a book consisting of thousands of literary entries on his Facebook page, which his students call Jeff Book. Jeff Nunakawa, the legend of Princeton, that's pretty heady stuff, you know, really heady stuff. Why don't you decide to make Facebook the most modern form of self-expression, a go-to page for literature?
Well, first of all, I just want to say something, which is I'm not putting myself in the same. I like my writing, but I even in my most megalomaniacal fantasy life, I don't actually compare it to F. Scott Fitzgerald.
He didn't graduate from Princeton, so
he was a great writer. I mean, he is a great writer. Anyway, in fact, I'll tell you a great line of Fitzgerald's, it means a lot to me. I think about it every single day.
Which is
somewhere in the notebooks. I think he writes, "At last, I have become a writer only," which I love that line, and it's a weird combination of, like, I don't know. I guess what I really like about it is that I think it's calm and self-knowing and a good place to imagine being when you get to a certain point in life.
It's okay. You can talk about F. Scott Fitzgerald.
I know, but I'll talk about Facebook first just because it's...
He didn't have a Facebook to go to.
Well, he sort of... Yeah, he had his own face to deal with. But I think, and I've thought about this a lot, and my main thought about Facebook, and I've said this, I've thought a lot about this, and I've said it in various ways, is that it's... Everyone goes to Facebook. I mean, Facebook is where people go, and I think of myself as having kind of like... just like a stand in a food court. Like, I like the idea that people go there and they'll read what I have to say or not, you know, depending on their mood or how much time they have. And I like to think about the possibility of reaching people with, you know, 2 minutes worth of, 3 minutes worth of, writing, which is, you know, very involved with calling forth the ghosts of writers who've helped and haunted me over the decades that I've studied them. And they'll have this. They'll have that 2 or 3 minutes while they're looking at other things. My accountant said something to me really smart. My accountant, whom I see once a year, and he's like a great therapist. He's a super great therapist. And he doesn't know he is, but he is. And he said to me, it was important. He said, you know, when I... He said, you don't need to... How did he put this? Actually, never mind, Mike. I don't want to talk about him. I love him, but I don't want to talk about him.
Wait a minute. We don't usually get accountants talking about literary things.
Well, he was just... Yeah,
finish it off.
Okay, well.
We have plenty of time to discuss this.
What he said to me was, which I really liked, was a few years ago, he said, you know, you should be trying to reach as many people as you can. you don't need to be reaching people who know the literature already. What you need to do is to reach people who can be helped by that literature who don't know it already. The way I want to help them is pretty straightforward. It's helping myself at the same time because it's a reminder, which is also a way of reminding myself of something. And that is that whatever pain, whatever humiliation, whatever anguish, whatever sense of despair that people are feeling, other people have felt too and have made their way through it and sometimes written about it and sometimes beautifully. There's a great Old English, it's actually a translation of an Old English poem, and the line is pretty simple and pretty, you know, universal. And the line is, it's a very lonely guy, and he, the speaker in this poem, and he says, translating now, "Others have gotten through things, maybe I can too."
Are you a lonely guy?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, not in a bad way. I mean, I like the way I'm lonely.
How are you lonely?
Well, I'm alone a lot, and I'm alone a great deal. And but I like being alone because I think it makes it, I think it makes me more fit society. It makes me more companionable when I'm with others.
Well, Facebook, you're with others in a way.
Yeah, but also I'm with others a lot at school. I'm with students more or less constantly when I'm, except when I go home and then I'm alone, but I like being alone. And I mean, whereas it's not like, this isn't like, oh, poor me. It's a loneliness that I like. I find it bracing. I find it relaxing. I find it a good opportunity to kind of reflect. And I write from a place of loneliness, quite literally. That is to say, I'm alone when I write. And, but also I'm thinking about, I mean, it's good to have, it's bracing in a good way, because I'm not the only lonely person in the world. Most of the people I'm writing to, whom I'm really reaching, they're lonely too. And as I say, it's not like in a particularly bad way. It's a general condition.
You're getting up in the morning and you're writing at, what, 5, 6 o'clock in the morning?
Whenever I
a
wake up.
A lot of people are lonely at that time.
Boom. Exactly. It's a certain, exactly. In fact, maybe everybody. And a lot of the writing is about, you know, pretty simple. Like, how have poets and philosophers and novelists and various other wise women and men taught us why and how to move from a horizontal position to a vertical position? How to get up. How to get up in the morning. How to meet the morning with something like, how to meet the light with something like light.
So you're up in the morning and you... Yeah. Have a need to start to write to communicate.
Oh, boom, right
boom.
Away. Yeah, that's the first thing I feel now. When I was young, I had other hungers. Now it's just a hunger to connect that way. It's the first thing I think.
And what do you do?
I get up and I put on my contact lenses and I go downstairs, or if I'm in New York, just to you know, just go to my desk, and I try to take account of how I'm feeling, and then I start grabbing for texts that are near or you know, far, whatever. And I have vast, like everyone, you know, I have vast stockpiles and a lot of books. And I try to find the text which I think most adequates and illuminates a particular emotional condition that I'm in the midst of, as a way of kind of, as I say, articulating it and reaching past it.
Is this kind of an exorcism of getting rid of your loneliness when you do that?
That's such a good question. Not so much getting rid of it as addressing it.
Confronting it.
Acknowledge. I wouldn't even say confronting because that sounds too, well, confrontational. Acknowledging it. Welcoming it. Welcoming it. That's the way I put it.
Well, how do you feel when you're doing it? I mean, give me an idea of how this... This sounds like it's almost physical.
Yeah, it is. Actually, it is. It is almost physical. I mean, usually it's one of two states. To be perfectly honest, and this sounds a little more depressing because I'm not a depressed guy.
It's not depressing.
Yeah, yeah. No, what I was going to say was I'm in one of two states. One is I'm either frankly feeling something like anguish or something or anxiety, and in fact, I was just having this mild panic attack when this interview started. I'm frequently in a state of panic, but I talk myself through it. One of the things that I notice is that by talking myself through it, I feel like I've helped other people talk themselves through it too. And why do I think that? I think that because I get a lot of messages of people saying, yeah, you helped me get through that day, so thanks for that. That's what you live for.
No panic right now, I hope.
No, not now, no.
I was worried.
I'm good. And believe me, you weren't making me panic.
Well, I was feeling a little guilty. Well, tell everybody.
This is so not on you.
Yeah, good. I feel better about that. I don't want it to be on me.
No, it's not. Dude, it's so not on you.
It makes me a real aggressive person. I'm not that aggressive.
You're not that aggressive.
And I'll tell everybody that the person who I was panicking is a guy named Jeff Nunakawa. And the program you're listening to is called Conversations with Alan Wolper, who's not panicking, and WBGO 88.3 FM, WBGO.org. You're a professor of English who the Princeton Alumni Weekly is calling the legend of Princeton. Do you know what? Your father says that being one of your parents is overwhelming.
Is that what he said?
Yeah. He was quoted as saying that. He wouldn't lie.
No, he wouldn't.
But this all started way back in Honolulu, right? Where you were born, and then something happened.
Well, I wasn't born. Yeah, lots happened. I mean, you know, and by the way, I don't think they said I was the legend, but...
You're a legend, at least.
Well, I've been there for a long time, and the students know me, and I know them, and I think we've learned how to... We learn a lot from each other. We learn a lot from each other every day.
Let's go back to Hawaii.
Yeah.
Where this all started, really. Literally.
Well, actually, I was born in Oregon, but much of it was in Hawaii. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's go. Let's start from Oregon.
Yeah, yeah.
Then you're in Hawaii.
Well, one of the things is really, and I think this actually was a really good thing, it's going to sound really bizarre, what I'm about to tell you.
Bizarre is good radio.
But I have a friend who said, I'll never forget this, who's a therapist, and he said to his girlfriend, and who repeated it to me, of course, and he meant this neutrally. I think he meant this neutrally. I don't think he was like trying to be arch or whatever. He said, Jeff was raised by a mother who taught him to believe, that everything he said was interesting. And I think that's kind of, now my mom is hard to rule my mom. She's very, but there's a way in which I think that guy was just on it. He was on point. But I'll tell you something. I don't think that's such a bad thing. It may be a recipe for raising a megalomaniac, but it's also a recipe for raising someone who can teach other people that what they say is interesting. People who don't normally think that what they say is interesting.
And you talk to your mother every day.
Every day, yeah. We're very close. Yeah.
And?
But I'll tell you something. I want to tell you something really that I'd really like about teaching students. And vis-a-vis interesting. So I want to give you an example of what I mean about teaching people how they're interesting. People who don't think that they're interesting. There was a girl, maybe she's listening to the show right now. She was at breakfast and she didn't seem like she had a lot of joy in her life. She worked hard. She does work hard. So I was trying to make conversation with her at breakfast. Just make a conversation like you're trying to make a conversation with me. And I said to her, so what do you do for fun? She said, I like movies. I said, what's your favorite movie? She said, Silence of the Lambs. Young thing. I said, really? Why? And she said, just looks at me straight on, like straight. She says, I like psychological thrillers. Boom. I thought, wow.
Should know that Silence of the Lambs is about a guy who goes around eating other people.
Yeah, amongst other things. Yeah, yeah.
Cannibalism in a way.
Yeah. In every way. But I just thought that was such a completely bland seeming brilliant response. I like psychological thrillers. I thought, wow, there are depths here. So we got really close.
Why is it? Did your father say what he said? Why are you so difficult?
That's a good question. I love the idea that my father thinks I'm difficult.
Well, no, he didn't say he says overwhelming to be Jeff Nunakawa's parent. It's interesting.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean...
Because you're manic? You're not manic.
I am manic, but I deliberately under-caffeinated myself today so that I wouldn't... Because you told me not to talk too fast. You warned me. You know, I don't know. I think the thing is, you know, the truth is, I don't know. How do you... what happened?
About your energy. Everything I've read is about you have an incredible amount of energy.
Well, I do, and so does the world. And we rev off each other. Even if I'm not feeling energetic, I'll walk into the dining hall and there's so much vibe. I'll feel the energy. You know, but I think the truth is I read a lot. I watched a lot of movies. Here's something interesting I haven't thought about for a long time. My father in particular, used to let me stay home from school sometimes. Just because if I said, I really want to read, or I need to think, I really need to think. And he would say, fine, stay home. Now, he was very strict, usually, like really strict. But if I said, I need to think, I got to read, or there's this old movie I have to see, I've almost seen all of, Mankiewicz's big movies. I got to see the rest. Fine. That was fine with him.
Well, you're lucky.
Well, lucky, whatever. I mean, he was a strict guy.
Most parents wouldn't understand that.
Yeah.
How old were you when he was letting you stay home?
13, 14, 15. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my parents were strict, but they were, sort of off the grid strict. I mean, they had their own rules, and they were, they had their own. I just remember this, I love this line. When people, like religious people, would come to our door, my mother would try to get there before my father, because my father would be so mean to them. But my mother would say, as quickly as she could, but as distinctly as she could, to these, proselytizers, quoting now, "We have our own faith. We have our own faith." And I was brought up in a house, many of us were, a lot of people were, that had its own faith.
And that faith is?
That faith was a belief in, improving the world. That it was a belief in it was a very, very clear sense of what mattered and what did not matter. And what mattered were things like, ideas, social justice, anything intellectual. What didn't matter were things like makeup, things like, none of that mattered. None of those things mattered. So it was I was really surprised by something that my mom said to me just recently in one of our daily conversations. She said, and I was going on about how terrible I look. And because, I'll tell you, as you well know, as anyone knows who's really vain, the secret of vanity is not that people love the way they look, it's that they're terrified of the way they look. CF, the picture of Dorian Gray. So I was saying to my mom, she said, 55, hell, I was just beginning my life at that age.
56 now.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. I thank you. Anyway, so she said, I said, but you know, it's funny, Mom, the difference between you and me is you're not vain, whereas I'm a really vain guy. And she said very, very uncharacteristically, what's the word I'm looking for? Easy on me, because usually she's pretty hard on me when I say stuff like that. She said, like the famous moment where I would come home to Honolulu and I'd take down all the pictures that she had of me up. And she said, why are you taking those pictures down? I said, I hate these pictures you take of me. She said, that's because you're vain. It's just the way you look. Face it. But anyway, so I said to her, but the problem is I'm really vain and you're not. And she said, you're right. That's a real cross to bear.
Well, your background, let's say your father's Japanese, your mother's Christian.
Yep, yep. Caucasian.
Obviously, you were taught in both places how to behave in both cultures, right?
Yeah. And rewarded, and frankly, at various points, rewarded for misbehaving. In various ways, rewarded for misbehaving. Yeah. Wow. Definitely.
Rewarded for misbehaving?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, totally. For example, sure. And I think it's important sometimes to be rewarded for misbehaving. My parents liked it when, I don't want to say it was disrespectful. They didn't like, they weren't for that. But if I dissented, if I, talked back to a teacher, they felt I was too obedient. So if I was, if I thought a teacher wasn't, was wrong about something in a literature class or whatever. I remember one teacher, a teacher of mine, I haven't thought about this for years. An English teacher my brother had, telling him that he couldn't do a report on, oh my God, it's like, what? I know. The Stranger. Camus' The Stranger. Why? It was too short. So I thought this was so idi-frickin-otic that I went and talked to this teacher on behalf of my brother. This teacher was pissed. And I guess she got in touch with my parents. I don't remember the details. But they thought that was just awesome. That's the way my parents are. I mean, both, that's the way in which they were like a united front.
And your book that's coming out courtesy of Princeton University Press next year.
Yeah.
You explained a lot of this, explained a lot of yourself.
Yeah.
And why you are who you are.
Yeah.
Who are you?
Yeah. Well, I mean.
I read your book, I just read your introduction.
Yeah.
Hand me over that.
Yep.
And that introduction is beginning to explain you. You said, so what is this book about? This book is a small selection from a big stock of brief essays I've written every day, one a day, over the course of what has become for many years now. Too many years now.
Many years now.
What's going to be in that book?
What's in the book are very brief essays. They are generally, you know, they're literary in nature, often, but not. I've tried to make them much and more and more. Like it used to be that my sort of go-to people would be Gerard Manley Hopkins and Henry James. Now it's much more E.B. White and Robert Frost. So what do these essays do? What these essays try to do is, I think it's a form of kind of, you know, response to literature, which I think is really important and kind of undervalued in the academy. And what it is not just like
the academic academy we're talking about.
Yeah, not just criticizing or analyzing an essay, but kind of inhabiting its spirit. That I'll begin with a quotation from, say, a Frost poem or a. Whatever. And what I'll try to do often is to channel the spirit of that text. So in some ways, homages, not exactly imitations, but sometimes it comes down to that. Someone else who's meant a lot to me is Samuel Johnson, Wordsworth, George Eliot, obviously. So there are ways in which I'm trying to less analyze in some formal way the text in front of me as to try to convey its spirit to someone else who, like me, is having difficulty getting the day started.
You've been called the Flying Hawaiian.
That was my friend Mary. Yeah.
Why are you the Flying Hawaiian?
Because when I'm at school, and I think what Merrill meant by that was I move really fast. I move around fast a lot. I can't, obviously, in the station because we're with a microphone, but I move pretty quick.
I'm trying to get you to move fast. You know, they're listening to you out there.
Yeah.
Conversation with Alan Walper, WBGO 88.3 FN and WBGO.org. Your students.
Yeah.
Tell us about your relationship with them.
Oh, my God. What's that word that they started using in the Bush administration? It's robust. I have a relation with students. I suppose, you know, to be honest, that is the single happiest, is the single most important source of happiness in my life is my relations with my students. I feel responsible to them, and I think they feel responsible to me. What do I mean by that? I mean, we learn a lot from each other. I think I bring my best game to them, and I think I bring their best game out of them. We read a lot together. They are very good, how do I put this, responding both formally and informally to the kind of intellectual life that I try to bring to them. I'll put it this way. Over the years, I've gotten, tons of messages or emails back from students. I've been there for a long time there now, you know, more than 25 years, saying, "Yo, Jeff or Professor, I really didn't understand what Middlemarch was about until I reached a certain age." I always say to them, and this is my standard shtick, this is what I say to the students, I always say, "You guys, you're not going to get Middlemarch until you're about 40. You just won't. You'll get parts of it, but you're not going to understand what the kind of disappointment that the novel talks about is like until you're older."
And what is Middlemarch?
Middlemarch is Eliot's great novel, and it's
many of them are that George Eliot is not a man.
Say it again. I don't know, and you know what? I don't care because it doesn't matter. Like what matters more is the sense that they have of an adult, the narrator, an adult narrator who remembers what it's like to not feel like an adult, who knows the fact, who knows that what being an adult is about is partly just putting on the act of being an adult. That's what the narrator knows of that novel really well, yeah.
I've seen YouTubes of you running around high-fiving students.
Yeah, we're good. I mean,
They call you Jeff?
Sure, I prefer it. Yeah, I prefer to earn my respect in different ways, yeah, than having formal titles, yeah, yeah.
Do some of them try to call you Professor Nunakawa?
Yeah, sure, and it's fine if they want to, but I think there are, and I'm for it. I'm not against it. It's just I prefer to earn respect in different ways. Yeah, I do. Like, I'll give you an example. This is gonna sound really weird, but there's a kid I just love this kid. And I was just doing my number, doing my song and dance. I can't remember what. I was just, you know, playing with his head in some wholesome way. And he turned to me and he just said, I just love this. He said, "You're a character. You're a character." I just thought that was a really funny thing for a kid to say to an adult. I really liked it.
Because you're a character.
Well, yeah, but he meant it in the most kind of enlightened and loving way possible. It's like he liked being in a world where there were characters. He knew he lived in a world where there were characters, and I was one of these characters. And
maybe he liked the idea that a Princeton professor could deal with him on that level.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. I think that's right. That's what I mean. I sort of feel like, you know, I'm at my best with my students, and I like to think that sometimes at least my students are at their best with me.
Are they good students?
Yeah, in very different ways. You know, it's an unusual kind of array of students.
The highest SATs in America, the best essays, the most competitive. What's it like teaching students like that?
It's just like, I mean, it's teaching human beings. I mean, they're that's what it is. Young people who, like the rest of us, are in more or less, you know, they're in more or less turmoil. They're also really funny. And I think this is just young people in general. I'll tell you what I like most about young people that I've noticed this. You know, this is the way that I think about this now. They like being honest. They like the truth. They really do. They really like the truth. And I like that.
And you like to give them the truth.
Well, I like not only to give it, I like to get it. They like to be truthful.
And they give it to you.
I think they do. Yeah, I think they do. And I like that about all kinds of things, about the world they live in, I like that. What I find with young people is that if they first of all, sometimes they don't know how, they can't dissemble. They haven't developed the skills for it. But secondly, they prefer being candid. It's like this. One of my former students said something to me really smart. I loved this comment. He said, "I like being truthful because it makes you closer to people. Sort of, as it were, skipping over the moral, you know, to be truthful is good or whatever. I like being truthful because it makes me feel closer to people. I love that. That itself is a truthful comment about truth."
You are the master of Rockefeller College, which
yep.
In other schools mean you're ahead of a dorm. Right?
You deal
with all this stuff, and people call you Master Jeff. I've heard say, "They adore him, they adore him," says the Princeton Alumni Weekly. "He needs his students, and they need him."
Yeah.
Why is that?
Well, the truth is, I don't have, I mean, it's as close as I have to a family life, and I mean that in a good way. I mean, actually, I was just describing my life to some parent. I said, "I have no personal life. I have really very little personal life." And I said this to these parents, this one parent, and they said, "It sounds so sad, but you seem so happy." And in fact, I am really happy. I'm a happy guy. It's like, the truth is this. Kids come away to college, and they want to be independent. And so, but there'll be these little moments where they'll need just like, what's the word I'm looking for? Like like 5 seconds of in loco parentis. They just need just the smell of it. And I'm there to supply it. So it's all good. So lacking a personal life, that fills it in a really good, I think it's a win-win.
How does that feel?
It feels great. It feels like, you know, honestly, it feels like, not presuming to know what it feels like to have kids, but it feels as close as I'm going to get to that, and it feels as blessed as I've ever been in my life. That's how it feels. That's how it feels. Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, they see that I've got nothing, that I'm not like, what's the word, that all I care about, that I'm on their side. That's how they feel. They feel like I'm on their side. I know they do, because I am, and they know it.
Jeff Nunakawa, professor of English at Princeton University, and an author of one of the most interesting faces on Facebook. Thanks for sharing your personal and professional life with us.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Joanna Walper is the senior producer of our program, and Doug Doyle is executive producer. Conrad Sanguinetti is our engineer, and Dana Damiani is a production associate. If you missed any part of this conversation, you can get a rewind by clicking Conversations with Alan Walper or get a free subscription on iTunes. Until next Tuesday night, I'm Alan Walper.
special thanks to Phantom Audio, a full-service production studio in New York's Flatiron District. And support for Conversations with Alan Wolper has been provided by the Blanche and Irving Laurie Foundation.